There was brief silence.
"You called Rachel," he said.
"Yes."
"Why?"
"Nothing important." There was another pause. Then Lenny said, "You're lying to me, right?" "Like a Vegas toupee." "Yeah, okay. Hey, we still on for racquetball tomorrow morning?" "I better cancel."
"No problem."
"Mark?"
"Yeah."
"If you need me."
"Thanks, Lenny." I hung up. Rachel was busy with her electronic gizmos. The words she had said were gone now. Dissipated smoke. She looked up and saw something in my face.
"Mark."
I didn't speak. "If your daughter is alive, we'll bring her home. I promise." And for the first time, I was not sure that I believed her. Chapter 21. Special Agent Tickner stared down at the report. The Sideman murder kidnapping had been beyond back burner. The FBI had realigned its priorities in recent years. Terrorism was number one on the most wanted list. Numbers 2 through 10 were, well, terrorism. The Sideman case had only involved him when it became a kidnapping issue. Despite what you see on television, the local police are usually anxious to have the FBI involved. The feds have the resources and the know-how. Calling them too late can cost a life. Regan had been smart enough not to wait. But once the kidnapping issue was, and he hated to use this term for it, resolved, Tickner's job, unofficially at least, was to back off and leave it to the locals. He still thought about it a lot. You don't forget the side of a baby's clothing in a cabin like that. But in his mind, the case had been inactive. Until 5 minutes ago. He read the brief report for the third time. He wasn't trying to put it together. Not yet. This was too weird for that. What he was trying to do, what he hoped to accomplish, was to find some kind of angle, some sort of handle he could grip. Nothing came to him. Rachel Mills. How the hell did she fit into this? A young subordinate. Tickner couldn't remember if his name was Kelly or Fitzgerald, something Irish like that, stood in front of the desk, hands not sure what to do. Tickner leaned back in the chair and crossed his legs. He tapped the pen against his lower lip. There has to be a connection between them, he told Sean or Patrick. She claimed to be a private detective. Is she licensed?
No, sir.
Tickner shook his head.
There's more to it than that. Check phone records, find some friends, whatever. Trace it down for me.
Yes, sir.
Call that detective agency, the MVD. Tell them I'm on my way.
Yes, sir. The Irish kid left. Tickner stared off. He and Rachel had gone through training together at Quantico. They'd both had the same mentor. Tickner thought about what to do here. While he didn't always trust the locals, he liked Regan. The guy was just off enough to be an asset. He picked up the phone and dialed Regan's cell.
"Detective Regan. Long time no speak."
"Ah, Federal Agent Tickner. You still wearing the sunglasses? You still stroking that soul patch? Among other things."
"Yes. And maybe."
Tickner could hear sitar music in the background.
"You busy?"
"Not at all. I was just meditating."
"Like Phil Jackson?"
"Exactly. Except I don't have all those pesky championship rings. You should join me sometime."
"Yeah, I'll put that on my list of must-dos."
"It would relax you, Agent Tickner,"
I hear tremendous strain in your voice.
Then I assume that there was a reason for this call.
Remember our favorite case?
There was a funny pause.
Yes.
How long has it been since we had something new?
I don't think we ever had anything new.
Well, we may now.
I'm listening.
We just got a strange call from an ex-FBI agent. Guy named Ward. He's a private dick in Newark now.
So?
It seems our friend Dr. Seidman paid his office a visit today. And he had someone very special with him.
Lydia dyed her hair black, the better to blend in with the night. The plan, as it were, was simple. We confirm that he has the money, she told Heshy. Then I kill him.
You sure?
Positive. And the beauty of it is, the murder will automatically get tied to the original shooting. Lydia smiled at him. Even if something goes wrong, nothing ties back to us.
Lydia?
Something the matter?
Heshy shrugged his giant shoulders.
Don't you think it would be better if I kill him?
I'm the better shot, Pooh Bear.
But, he hesitated, shrugged again. I don't need a weapon.
You're trying to protect me, she said.
He said nothing.
That's sweet.
And it was.
But one of the reasons she wanted to do it herself was to protect Heshy. He was the vulnerable one here. Lydia never worried about getting caught. Part of it was classic overconfidence. Dumb people get caught, not those who were careful. But more than that, she knew if she did get nabbed, they'd never convict her. Forget her still girl-next-door looks, though that would undoubtedly be an asset. What no prosecutor would ever overcome would be the weepy Oprahization of her case. Lydia would remind them of her tragic past. She would claim abuses in many forms. She would cry on the talk shows. She would talk about the plight of the child star, of the calamity of being forced into the world of Pixie Trixie. She would look adorably victimized and innocent. And the public, not to mention the jury, would lap it up.
I think it's best this way, she told him. If he sees you approach, well, he is apt to run. But if he catches sight of little old me...
Lydia let her voice die out with a small shrug. As she nodded,
she was right. This should be cake.
She stroked his face and handed him the car keys.
Does Pavel understand his part? Lydia asked.
He does. He'll meet us there. And yes, he'll be wearing the flannel shirt.
Then we might as well start on our way, she said. I'll call Dr. Seidman. Heshy used the remote to unlock the car doors.
Oh, she said, I have to check something before we go.
Lydia opened the back door. The child was fast asleep in the car seat. She checked the straps and made sure that they were secure.
I better sit in the back, Pooh Bear, she said, just in case a little someone wakes up.
Heshy angled his way into the driver's seat. Lydia took out the phone and voice changer and dialed the number. Chapter 22. We ordered a pizza, which I think was a mistake. Late-night pizzas are college. It was yet another not-so-subtle reminder of the past. I kept staring at the mobile phone, wishing it to ring. Rachel was quiet, but that was okay. We had always been good with silence. That, too, was weird. In many ways, we were falling back, picking up where we'd left off. But in many more ways, we were strangers with a tenuous, awkward connection. What was odd was that my memories were suddenly hazy. I'd thought that once I saw her again, they'd head straight to the surface. But few specifics came to me. It was more a feeling, an emotion, like the way I remembered the ruddy cold of New England. I don't know why I couldn't remember, and I wasn't sure what it meant. Rachel's brow creased as she toyed with the electronic equipment. She took a bite of pizza and said, "Not as good as Tony's." "That place was awful." "A little greasy," she agreed. "A little? Didn't the large come with a coupon for a free angioplast?" "Well, there was that sludge through the veins feel to it." We looked at each other. "Rachel?"
"Yeah."
"Suppose they don't call."
"Then they don't have her, Mark."
I let that settle in. I thought about Lenny's son, Connor, the things he could say and do, and I tried to apply it to the baby I'd last laid eyes on in her crib. It wouldn't compute, but that didn't mean anything. There was hope. I held on to that. If my daughter was dead, if that phone never rang again, the hope would, I know, kill me. But I didn't care. Better to go down this way than try to go the distance. So I had hope. And I, the cynic, let myself believe the best. When the cell phone finally did ring, it was nearly 10. I did not even glance over to Rachel and wait for her nod. My finger was on the answer button before the first chirp could die off. "Hello." "Okay," the robotic voice said. "You'll get to see her." I couldn't breathe. Rachel moved over closer and put her ear near mine. "Good," I said.
"Do you have the money?"
"Yes."
"All of it?"
"Yes." "Then listen closely. Deviate from what I tell you and we disappear. Do you understand?"
"Yes."
"We checked with our police sources. So far, so good. It appears that you haven't contacted the authorities. But we need to make sure. You will drive alone toward the George Washington Bridge. Once there, we will be in range. Use the two-way radio feature on the phone. I will tell you where to go and what to do. You will be searched. If we find any weapons or wires, we will disappear. Do you understand?" I could feel Rachel's breath quicken.
"When do I see my daughter?"
"When we meet."
"How do I know you won't just take the money?"
"How do you know I'm not going to hang up on you now?"
"I'm on my way," I said.
Then I quickly added, "But I won't hand over the money until I see Tara." "Then we are in agreement. You have an hour. Signal me then."
Chapter 23.
Conrad Dorfman did not appear happy to be dragged back into the MVD office this late. Tickner didn't care. If Seidman had come here alone, that would be an important lead, no doubt about it. But the fact that Rachel Mills had been here too, that she was somehow involved, well, let's just say that Tickner's curiosity was more than piqued.
"Did Ms. Mills show you an ID?" he asked.
"Yes," Dorfman replied.
"But it was stamped retired."
"And she was with Dr. Seidman?"
"Yes."
"They arrived together?"
"I think so. I mean, yes, when they came in here, they were together."
Tickner nodded.
"What did they want?"
"A password. For a CD-ROM."
"I'm not sure I follow."
They claimed that they had a CD-ROM we provided to a client. Our CDs are password protected. They wanted us to give them the password.
Did you?
Dorfman looked properly shocked.
Of course not.
We had a call put into your agency.
They explained to us.
Well, they never quite explained to us anything, really. They just stressed that we should not cooperate with Agent Mills in any way.
Ex-agent, Tickner said.
How? Tickner wondered.
How the hell had Rachel Mills hooked up with Seidman?
He had tried to give her the benefit of the doubt.
Unlike his fellow agents, he had known her, had seen her in action. She'd been a good agent, maybe even a great one. But now he wondered. He wondered about the timing. He wondered about her being here. He wondered about her flashing her badge and trying to apply pressure.
Did they tell you how they came by this CD-ROM?
They claimed that it belonged to Dr. Seidman's wife.
Does it?
I believe so, yes.
Are you aware that his wife died more than a year and a half ago, Mr. Dorfman?
I know that now.
But you didn't when they were here.
Right.
Why did Seidman wait 18 months to ask for the password?
He didn't say.
Did you ask?
Dorfman shifted in his seat.
No.
Tickner smiled, buddy to buddy.
No reason you should, he said, faux genteel.
Did you give them any information at all?
None.
You didn't tell them why Mrs. Seidman hired your agency in the first place?
That's correct.
Okay. Very good.
Tickner leaned forward, his elbows on his knees now. He was about to ask another question when his cell phone rang.
Excuse me, he said, reaching into his pocket.
Is this going to take much longer? Dorfman asked. I have plans.
He didn't even bother responding. Rising, he put the phone to his ear.
Tickner.
It's Agent O'Malley, the young kid said.
Did you find anything?
Oh, yeah.
I'm listening.
We checked the phone records going back 3 years. Seidman never called her.
At least not from his house or office until today.
Am I about to hear a but?
You are.
But Rachel Mills called him. Once.
When?
June, 2 years ago.
Tickner did the math.
That would have been about 3 months before the murder and kidnapping.
Anything else?
Something big, I think.
I had one of our agents check Rachel's apartment in Falls Church. He's still poking around, but guess what he found in her night table drawer?
Does this look like a quiz show, Orion?
O'Malley.
Tickner rubbed the bridge of his nose.
What did the agent find?
A prom photo.
What?
I mean, I don't know if it's from the prom, exactly.
It's some kind of old formal.
Photo gotta be 15, 20 years old. She's wearing her hair in some flip style, and she's got one of those flower bands on her arm. What do you call those?
A corsage.
Right.
What the hell does this have to do with the guy in the picture?
What about him?
Our agent is sure. The guy she's with, her date, I mean, is our own Dr. Seidman.
Tickner felt the thrum rush through him.
Keep digging, he said. Call me when you get more.
On it. He hung up the phone. Rachel and Seidman went to a prom together? What the hell was going on? She was from Vermont, if he remembered correctly.
Seidman lived in New Jersey. They didn't go to high school together. How about college? They'd have to look into it.
Something wrong? Tickner turned. It was Dorfman.
Let me see if I have this straight, Mr. Dorfman. This CD-ROM belonged to Monica Seidman.
That's what we were told, yes.
Yes or no, Mr. Dorfman?
He cleared his throat.
We believe the answer is yes.
So she was a client here?
Yes, that we've been able to confirm.
So, to sum up, a murder victim was a client of yours.
Silence.
Her name was in every paper in the state, Tickner went on, giving him the hard stare. How come you never came forward?
We didn't know.
Tickner kept with the hard stare.
The guy who handled that case is no longer employed by us, he added quickly. See, he was gone by the time Mrs. Seidman was killed, so no one here put the pieces together.
Defensive. Tickner liked that. He believed him, but he didn't show it. Make the guy anxious to please.
What was on the CD?
Photographs, we think.
Think?
That's usually the case. Not always. We use the CD to store photographs, but there could be some scanned documents, too. I really couldn't tell you.
Why the hell not?
He put up both hands.
Don't worry. We have a backup. But any file more than a year old is stored in the basement.
The office was closed, but when I heard you were interested, I got someone to come in. He's running off the material on the backup CD right now.
Where?
He's on the lower level.
Dorfman checked his watch.
He should be done, or just about by now.
Do you want to go down and see?
Tickner stood.
Let's rumble.
Chapter 24.
There are still things we can do, Rachel said. This stuff is state-of-the-art. Even if they pat you down, we can get away with it. I have a bulletproof vest that has a pinhole camera right in the center.
And you don't think they'll find that with a pat down?
Yeah, okay. Look, I know you're worried about them finding out, but let's be realistic here. There's an excellent chance this is all a setup. Don't give up the money until you see Tara. Don't get yourself stuck somewhere alone.
Don't worry about the cue logger.
If they're being up front, we'll have Tara before they can search the stacks of money. I know this isn't an easy decision, Mark.
No, you're right. I played it safe last time. I think we need to take some chances, but the vest is out.
Okay, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to be in the trunk. They may check the back seat to see if someone is lying there. The trunk will be a safer bet. I'll disconnect the wires back there so when the trunk opens, no lights will come on. I'll try to keep up with you, but I have to stay at a safe distance. Make no mistake here, I'm not Wonder Woman. I might lose you, but remember, don't look for me, not even casually. These guys are probably pretty good. They'll spot that.
I understand.
She was dressed totally in black.
I said, you look like you're going to do a reading in the village.
Kumbaya, my lord. You ready?
We both heard the car pull up. I looked out the window and felt my panic needle jump.
Damn, I said.
What?
That's Regan, the cop on the case.
I haven't seen him in more than a month.
I looked at her.
Her face was stark white against the black outfit.
Coincidence?
No coincidence, she said.
How the hell did he find out about the ransom? She moved back from the window. He's probably not here for that.
Then what?
My guess would be that they got word of my involvement from MVD.
I frowned.
So?
No time to explain. Look, I'm going to go out to the garage and hide. He's going to ask about me. Tell him I went back to D.C. If he presses, tell him I'm an old friend and leave it at that. He's going to want to interrogate you.
Why?
But she was already moving away from me. Just be firm and get him out of there. I'll wait for you by the car.
I didn't like it, but now was not the time.
Okay.
Rachel headed to the garage via the door in the den. I waited until she was out of sight. When Regan hit my front walkway, I opened the door, trying to cut him off at the pass. Regan smiled.
Were you expecting me?
He asked. I heard your car.
He nodded, as if I'd said something that required serious analysis.
Do you have a few moments, Dr. Seidman?
Actually, it's a bad time.
Oh.
Regan did not break stride. He slid past me and into my front foyer, his eyes taking in everything.
Heading out, are we?
What do you want, detective?
Some new information has come to our attention.
I waited for him to say more.
Don't you want to know what it is?
Of course.
Regan had a strange, almost serene look on his face. He looked up at the ceiling as if he were considering what color to paint it.
Where have you been today?
Get out, please.
His eyes were still on the ceiling.
Your hostility surprises me.
But he did not look surprised.
You said you had some new information. If you do, say it. If not, get out. I'm not in the mood to be questioned.
He made a well face. We hear that you visited a private detective agency in Newark today.
So?
So what were you doing there?
Tell you what, detective. I'm going to ask you to leave because I know answering your questions will bring me no closer to finding my daughter.
He looked at me.
You sure about that?
Kindly get the hell out of my house, now.
Suit yourself.
Regan started for the door. When we reached it, he asked, Where's Rachel Mills?
Don't know.
She's not here.
Nope.
No idea at all where she could be.
I think she's on her way back to Washington.
How do you two know each other?
Good night, detective.
Okay, sure. But one last question. I stifled a sigh.
You've watched too many episodes of Columbo, detective.
Indeed, I have.
He smiled. But let me ask it anyway.
I spread my hands for him to go ahead.
Do you know how her husband died?
He was shot, I said too quickly, and immediately regretted it. He leaned a little more into my space and kept on me.
And do you know who shot him?
I stood without moving.
Do you, Mark?
Good night, detective.
She killed him, Mark.
A bullet to the head at close range.
That, I said, is a load of bull.
Is it?
I mean, are you sure?
If she killed him, why isn't she in jail?
Good question, Regan said, backing down the walkway. When he reached the end of the walkway, he added, Maybe you should ask her.
Chapter 25 Rachel was in the garage. She looked up at me. She suddenly looked small, I thought, and I saw fear in her face. The car trunk was open.
I moved toward the driver's side door.
What did he want? She asked.
What you said.
He knew about the CD.
He knew we'd been at MVD. He didn't say anything about the CD.
I slid into the car.
She let it drop. Now was not the time to raise any new issues. We both knew that. But again, I questioned my judgment here. My wife had been murdered. So had my sister. Someone had tried very hard to kill me. Stripping it bare, I was trusting a woman I really didn't know. I was trusting her not only with my life, but with my daughter's. How stupid when you think about it. Lenny had been right. It was not so simple. In truth, I had no idea who she was or what she'd become. I had deluded myself into making her something she might not be, and now I wondered what it might cost me. Her voice cut through my haze. Mark?
What?
I still think you should wear the bulletproof vest.
No.
My tone was firmer than I'd wanted. Or maybe not. Rachel climbed into the trunk and closed it. I put the duffel bag with the money on the seat next to me. I hit the garage door opener under the sun visor and started the car. We were on our way. When Tickner was 9 years old, his mother bought him a book of optical illusions. You'd look at a drawing of, say, an old lady with a big nose. You'd look a little longer and then, poof, it appeared now to be a young woman with her head turned. Tickner had loved the book. When he got a little older, he moved on to those magic eyes, staring for however long it took for the horsey or whatever to appear in the swirling colors. Sometimes it would take a long time. You'd even start to wonder if there was anything there at all. And then suddenly, the image surfaced. That was what was happening here. There were moments in a case, Tickner knew, that altered everything, just like those old optical illusions. You were viewing one reality, and then, with a gentle tilt, reality changes. Nothing is as it appeared. He had never really bought the conventional theories on the Sidemen murder kidnapping. They all felt too much like reading a book with missing pages. Over the years, Tickner had not dealt with that many murders. They were, for the most part, left to the local cops. But he knew plenty of homicide investigators. The best ones were always off-center, overly theatrical, ridiculously imaginative. Tickner had heard them talk about a point in the case where the victim reaches out from the grave. The victim talks to them somehow, pointing them toward their killer. Tickner would listen to his nonsense and nod politely. It always sounded like a load of hyperbole, just one of those meaningless things cops say because the general public laughs it up. The printer still whirred. Tickner had seen 12 photos already. How many more? He asked.
Dorfman looked at the computer screen.
6 more.
Same as these?
Pretty much, yeah.
I mean, same person.
Tickner stared down at the photographs. Yes, the same person was featured in all of them. They were all in black and white, all taken without the subject knowing, probably from a distance with a zoom lens. The reach from the grave stuff? It no longer sounded so silly. Monica Sidemen had been dead for 18 months. Her murderer had gone free, and now, with all hope lost, she seemed to have risen from the dead to point a finger. Tickner looked again and tried to understand. The subject of the pictures, the person Monica Sidemen was pointing at, was Rachel Mills. When you take the eastern spur of the New Jersey Turnpike north,
The night skyline of Manhattan beckons. Like most people who see it nearly every day, I used to take it for granted. No more. For a while afterward, I thought I could still see the towers. It was as though they were bright lights I'd stared at for a long time, so that even when I closed my eyes, their images were still there, embedded. But like any sunspot, the images eventually began to fade. It is different now. When I drive this route, I still make myself look for them. Even tonight. But sometimes now I forget precisely where those towers stood. And that angers me more than I can express. Out of habit, I took the lower level of the George Washington Bridge. There was no traffic at this hour. I drove through the easy pass. I had managed to keep myself distracted. I flipped stations between two talk radio shows. One was a sports station where lots of guys named Vinny from Bayside called up and complained about inept coaches and how much better they'd be at the job. The other station featured two beyond puerile Howard Stern ripoffs who thought it was funny for a college freshman to call his mother and tell her he had testicular cancer. Both were, if not entertaining, mildly distracting. Rachel was in the trunk, which was totally weird if I thought about it. I reached for the cell phone and flipped on the two-way radio feature. My finger pressed down on the call button, and almost instantly I heard the robotic voice say, "Take the Henry Hudson North." I put the phone to mouth, walkie-talkie style. "Okay. Tell me the moment you get on the Hudson." "Right." I got into the left lane. I knew the way. This area was familiar to me. I had done a fellowship at New York Presbyterian, which resided about 10 blocks south. Zia and I had roomed with a cardiac resident named Lester in an Art Deco building at the tail end of Fort Washington Avenue in upper Manhattan. When I lived here, this section of the city was known as the far northern point of Washington Heights. Now I had noticed several realtors redubbing it Hudson Heights, so as to differentiate it, in both substance and cost, from its lower-class roots. "Okay, I'm on the Hudson," I said. "Take your next exit." "Fort Tryon Park?" "Yes." Again, I knew it. Fort Tryon floats cloud-like high above the Hudson River. It is a quiet and restful, jagged cliff, New Jersey on its west, Riverdale Bronx on its east. The park is a mishmash of terrains, walkways of harsh stone, fauna from a bygone era, terraces of stone, nooks and crannies of cement and brick, thick brush, rocky slopes, open grass. I had spent plenty of summer days on her green lawns, adorned in shorts and t-shirt, Zia and unread medical books, my companions. My favorite time here? Summer, right before dark. The orange glow bathing the park in something almost ethereal. I put on my blinker and glided onto the exit ramp. There were no cars and few lights. The park was closed at night, but the roadway stayed open for through traffic. My car chugged up the steep road and entered what felt like a medieval fortress. The cloisters, a former quasi-French monastery that was now part of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, held middle ground. It houses a fabulous collection of medieval artifacts. Or so I'm told. I've been in this park 100 times. I've never been inside the cloisters. It was, I thought, a smart place for a ransom drop. Dark, quiet, filled with serpentine trails, stone cliffs, sudden drops, thick woods, paved and unpaved walks. You could get lost here. You could hide here for a very long time and never be found. The robotic voice asked, "Are you there yet?" "I'm in Fort Tryon, yes." "Park near the cafe. Get out and walk up to the circle."
Riding in the trunk was noisy and jarring. Rachel had brought a padded blanket, but there was not much she could do about the noise. A flashlight stayed in her satchel. She had no interest in turning it on. Rachel had never minded the dark. Sight could be distracting. The dark was a good place to think. She tried to keep her body loose, riding bumps, and wondered about Mark's behavior right before they left. The cop at the house had, no doubt, said something that shook him. About her? Probably. She wondered what exactly he had said and how she should react. Didn't matter now. They were on their way. She had to concentrate on the task at hand. Rachel was falling back into a familiar role. There was a pang here. She missed being with the FBI. She had loved her job. Yes, perhaps it was all she had. It was more than her escape. It was the only thing she really enjoyed doing. Some people pushed through the 9-to-5 so they could go home and live their lives. For Rachel, it was the opposite. After all these years apart, here was something that she and Mark had in common. They'd both found careers they loved. She wondered about that. She wondered if there was a connection, if their careers had become some kind of true love substitute. Or was that looking at it too deeply? Mark still had his job. She did not. Did that make her more desperate? No. His child was gone. Game, set, match. In the darkness of the trunk, she smeared her face with black makeup, enough to take the shine away. The car started climbing upward. Her gear was packed and ready. She thought about Hugh Riley, the son of a bitch. Her breakup with Mark and everything after was his fault. Hugh had been her dearest friend in college. That was what he wanted, he told her, just to be her friend, no pressure. He understood that she had a boyfriend. Had Rachel been naive or purposefully naive? Men who want to just be friends do so because they hope to be next in line, as though friendship were an on-deck circle, a good place for practice swings before heading to the plate. Hugh had called her in Italy that night with nothing but the best of intentions. "I just think you should know," he said, "as your friend." Right. And then he told her what Mark had done at some stupid frat party. Yes, enough blaming herself. Enough blaming Mark. Hugh Riley. If that son of a bitch had just minded his own business, what would her life be like right now? She couldn't say. Ah, but what had her life become? That was easier to answer. She drank too much. She had a bad temper. Her stomach bothered her more than it should. She spent too much time reading TV Guide. And let's not forget the pièce de résistance. She had gotten herself ensnared in a self-destructive relationship and gotten herself out of it in the worst way possible. The car veered and climbed upward, forcing Rachel to roll back. A moment or two later, the car stopped. Rachel lifted her head. The cruel musings fled. It was game time. From the old fort's lookout tower, some 250 feet above the Hudson River, Heshey had one of the most stunning views of the Jersey Palisades, stretching from the Tappan Zee Bridge on the right to the Washington Bridge on his left. He actually took the time to appreciate it before he got to the matter at hand. As though on cue, Seidman took the exit off the Henry Hudson Parkway. No one followed. Heshey kept his eyes on the road. No car slowed, no car sped up. No one was trying to make it look as though they weren't following. He spun around, lost sight of the car for a brief moment, then spotted it again as it came back into view. He could see Seidman in the driver's seat. No one else was visible. That didn't mean much. Someone could be ducking down in the back. But it was a start. Seidman parked the car. He turned off the engine and opened the door. Heshey lifted the microphone to his mouth. "Pavel, you ready?"
"Yes."
"He's alone," he said, speaking now for Lydia's benefit. "Proceed." "Park near the cafe. Get out and walk up to the circle." The circle I knew was Margaret Corbin Circle. When I reached the clearing, the first thing I spotted, even in the dark, were the bright colors of the children's playground near Fort Washington Avenue at 190th Street. The colors still leapt out. I'd always liked this playground, but tonight the yellows and blues taunted me. I thought of myself as a city boy. When I lived near here, I imagined staying in this neighborhood. Too sophisticated was I for the vanilla suburbs, and of course that meant that I would bring my children to this very park. I took that as an omen, but I didn't know of what. The phone squawked. "There's a subway station on the left."
"Okay."
"Take the stairs down toward the elevator." I might have suspected this. He would put me on the elevator and then on the A train. It would be difficult, if not impossible, for Rachel to follow me.
"Are you on the stairs?"
"Yes."
"At the bottom you'll see a gate on the right."
I knew where it was. It led to a smaller park and was locked except for weekends. It had been set aside as something of a small picnic area. There were ping-pong tables, though you had to bring your own net and paddles to play. There were benches and eating areas. Kids used it for birthday parties. The wrought iron gate, I remember, was always locked.
"I'm there," I said.
"Make sure no one sees you. Push open the gate. Slip through and quickly close it." I peered inside. The park was black. Distant streetlights reached out and gave the area no more than a dull glow. The duffel bag felt heavy. I adjusted it up my shoulder. I looked behind me now. No one. I looked to my left. The subway elevators were still. I put my hand on the gate door. The padlock had been cut. I gave the area one more quick glance because that was what the robotic voice had told me to do. No sign of Rachel. The gate creaked when I pushed it open. The echo ripped through the still night. I slipped through the opening and let the dark swallow me whole. Rachel felt the car rock as Mark got out. She made herself wait a full minute, which felt like 2 hours. When she thought that it was probably safe, Rachel lifted the trunk an inch and peeked out. She saw no one. Rachel had a gun with her, a Fed-issue Glock 22 40-caliber semi-automatic, and she carried her night-vision goggles. Rigel 3501 military-grade Gen 2+. The Palm Pilot that could read the Q-Logger transmitter was in her pocket. She doubted that anyone would see her, but she still only opened the trunk wide enough so she could roll out. She huddled down low. Her hand reached back and grabbed the semi-automatic and night vision goggles. Then she quietly closed the trunk. Field operations had always been her favorite, or at least the training for them. There had been very few missions that required this sort of cloak-and-dagger reconnaissance. For the most part, stakeouts were high-tech. You had vans and spy planes and fiber optics. You rarely found yourself crawling through the night in black clothes and grease paint. She made herself small against the back tire. In the distance, she saw Mark heading up the drive. She put the gun in its holster and strapped the night vision goggles to her belt. Keeping low, Rachel moved up the grass to higher ground. There was still enough light. She didn't need the goggles yet. A sliver of moon sliced through the sky. There were no stars tonight. Up ahead, she could see that Mark had the cell phone near his ear. The duffel bag was on his shoulder. Rachel looked around, saw no one. Would the drop take place here? It wasn't a bad place if you had a planned escape route. She started to think about the possibilities. Fort Tryon was hilly. The secret would be to try to get higher. She started climbing and was just about to settle in when Mark exited the park. Damn. She'd have to move again. Rachel Commando crawled down the hill. The grass was prickly and smelled like hay, the cause being, she assumed, the recent water shortage. She tried to keep her eyes on Mark, but she lost him when he left the park grounds. She took a risk and moved quicker. At the park gate, she ducked behind a stone pillar. Mark was there, but not for very long. With the phone back to his ear, Mark veered to the left and vanished down the steps leading to the A-train. Up ahead, Rachel saw a man and a woman walking a dog. They could be part of this. Or they could be a man and a woman walking a dog. Mark was still out of sight. No time for debate now. She ducked low at a stone wall. Leaning her back against it, Rachel made her way toward the stairs. Tickner thought that Edgar Portman looked like something out of a Noel Coward production. He wore silk pajamas under a red robe that appeared to have been tied with great care. There were velvet slippers on his feet. His brother Carson, on the other hand, looked properly ruffled. His pajamas were askew. His hair was all over the place. His eyes were bloodshot. Neither Portman could take his eyes off the photographs from the CD. "Edgar," Carson said, "let's not jump to conclusions." "Not jump?" Edgar turned to Tickner. "I gave him money." "Yes, sir," Tickner said. "A year and a half ago. We know about that." "No." Edgar tried to make the words snap with impatience, but he didn't have the strength. "I mean, recently. Today, in fact." Tickner sat up. "How much?" $2 million. There was another ransom demand. "Why didn't you contact us?" "Oh, sure." Edgar made a sound that was half chortle, half sneer. "You all did such a wonderful job last time." Tickner felt the tick in his blood. "Are you saying that you gave your son-in-law an additional $2 million? "That is precisely what I'm saying." Carson Portman was still staring at the photographs. Edgar glanced at his brother, then back at Tickner. "Did Mark Seidman kill my daughter?" Carson stood up. "You know better." "I'm not asking you, Carson." Both men looked at Tickner now. Tickner was not having any of it. "You said you met with your son-in-law today." If Edgar was upset about his question being ignored, he did not show it. "Early this morning," he said. "At Memorial Park." "That woman in the pictures." Tickner gestured toward them. "Was she with him?" "No." "Has either of you ever seen her before?" Both Carson and Edgar answered in the negative. Edgar picked up one of the photographs. "My daughter
hired a private investigator to take these?
Yes.
I don't understand. Who is she?
Tickner again ignored his question. The ransom note came to you, like last time.
Yes.
I'm not sure I follow. How did you know that it wasn't a hoax? How did you know that you were dealing with the real kidnappers?
Carson took that one.
We did think it was a hoax, he said.
At first, I mean.
So what changed your mind?
They sent hairs again.
Carson quickly explained about the tests and about Dr. Seidman's request for additional tests.
You gave him all the hairs then?
We did, yes, Carson said.
Edgar seemed lost in the photographs again.
This woman, he spat. Was Seidman involved with her?
I can't answer that.
Why else would my daughter want these pictures taken?
A mobile phone rang. Tickner excused himself and put the receiver to his ear.
Bingo,
O'Malley said.
What?
We got a hit on Seidman's easy pass.
He crossed the Washington Bridge 5 minutes ago.
The robotic voice told me, walk down the path. There was still enough light to see the first few steps. I started down them. The darkness gathered around, closed in. I started to use my foot to feel my way, like a blind man swinging a cane. I didn't like this. I didn't like this at all. I wondered again about Rachel. Was she near here? I tried to follow the path. It curved to the left. I stumbled on the cobblestone.
Okay, the voice said. Stop.
I did so. I could see nothing in front of me. Behind me, the street was a faded glow. On my right was a steep incline. The air had that city park smell to it, a swirling potpourri of fresh and stale. I listened for some sort of clue, but there was nothing other than the distant, humming swish of traffic.
Put down the money.
No, I said. I want to see my daughter.
Put down the money.
We had a deal. You show me my daughter, I show you the money. There was no reply. I could hear the blood roaring in my ears. The fear was crippling. No, I did not like this. I was too exposed. I checked the path behind me. I could still break into a run and scream like a psycho. This neighborhood was tighter than most in Manhattan. Someone might call the police or try to help.
Dr. Seidman?
Yes? And then a flashlight hit my face. I blinked and raised a hand to block my eyes. I squinted, trying to see past it. Someone lowered the flashlight beam. My eyes quickly adjusted, but there was no need. The beam was cut off by a silhouette. There was no mistake. I could see immediately what was being highlighted. There was a man. I may have even seen flannel, I'm not sure. As I said, it was in silhouette. I couldn't really make out features or colors or design. So that part could have been my imagination. But not the rest. I saw the shapes and outlines clear enough to know. Standing next to the man, gripping his leg, just above the knee, was a small child. Chapter 26. Lydia wished that there were more light. She would very much like to see the look on Dr. Seidman's face right now. Her desire to see his expression had nothing to do with the cruelty that was about to come down. It was curiosity. It was deeper than the slow to see the car accident aspect of human nature. Imagine. This man had had his child taken away. For a year and a half.